We're going to read today from the first book of the Bible. It is the book of Genesis. We're going to read in chapter 39. If you're new to our service here in Smithton, we are working through a box set of episodes from the life of Joseph. Many of you are working through box sets on Netflix and Amazon or whatever it might be. Here we're working through a very different box set, but it is nonetheless dramatic as it teaches us many, many things that God wants us to learn. We are following the life of Joseph, a man whose life was filled with so many issues and episodes that have captured the imagination for people for many, many years. Whether it's poems that have been written about him or West End musicals, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, the story of Joseph, the account of Joseph, has captivated minds. And so our lockdown viewing in that sense is the box set that the Bible gives to us about Joseph. And today we're going to be thinking, our episode is going to be based around the words of chapter 39. Up until this point, Joseph, having been the favored son, has been on the receiving end of the growing hatred from his brothers. They have torn off that symbol of the love that the father had, this great ornate coat his father had given him. They'd thrown him in a pit, going to leave him to die. The last minute they changed their minds. Instead, they sold him as a slave. They lied to his father that he was somehow dead, or they implied to his father that he was somehow dead. Joseph was taken to a foreign country, foreign culture, foreign language, sold as a slave. The last episode we saw at the beginning of chapter 39, how he even thrived in that 11 years a slave. And so we're going to be thinking today what happens in the second part of chapter 39. But just to set it in context, let me read for you the whole chapter. This is God's word. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to him, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. "That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." When his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Please do, if you have a Bible with you, open it at Genesis 39 or turn to it in your mobile phone, your YouVersion app, whatever it might be. Genesis chapter 39, as we have our next installment in our series in the life of Joseph. One technique that some dramas use is that oftentimes throughout a series that they will take you to the final scene, and that will be the first scene of a new episode. And then the episode will show how the characters got from where they left off to that final scene. So it'll start and end at the same position, as it were. Well, if we followed that technique today, we'd be thinking of Joseph at the end of this chapter, our lead character. We'd be thinking of him in a cell. He's gone from a penthouse where he was in charge of all that was happening in his master's house, and he is now in a prison cell. He is in a prison cell, and he is in chains, and his feet are shackled, his neck is in chains, so Psalm 105 tells us. And we could almost picture him leaning against a wall in that dark, dank cell, wondering what on earth has taken place. You may say, but didn't we leave him at the end of the last episode when everything was going so well? He'd known promotion. He had influence. He wasn't living in the slave's quarters. He was living in his master's house. Now, his master, he was more than an attendant. He was the assistant. He was the CEO of the household, as it were. How on earth have things come to this situation? He is now in this prison cell, and he's reaching, he's not quite there, but he's reaching almost the lowest point that he's going to reach. He was a man who was in charge of his master's affairs, and yet because of something that he did not do, he ends up in prison. Because he would not have an affair with his master's wife, he ends up in prison. And so if you've ever been unfairly treated, if you've ever been lied against, if you've ever been on the wrong end of vindictive treatment, and many of us have, then there is a message today from this part of the Bible that speaks exactly into our lives. So do stay with us as we study Genesis chapter 39. Let me begin today by introducing you to a woman who walks onto the scene in verse 7. She's not named. She is Potiphar's wife, and she is one mixed up individual. From the outside, she is somebody who may give the appearance that she has everything sorted. She is married to this guy who is the chief of the defense staff, could be translated chief of the executioners, but he's so prominent in this kingdom. So she's married to a guy of influence and riches. And so the lifestyle of the rich and famous is what she has. From the outside, it might appear to be really quite appealing. However, the reality is that for her, she is somebody who's not happy. And what we learn of this mixed up individual is that she has not simply an adulterous heart, but she has this consuming lust. She is a liar of the highest order. She's a manipulator, and she has a murderous, vindictive streak that is part of her character. The problem is, she has set her sights on Joseph. And Joseph is, in the words of verse 6, he's well built and he is handsome. He is this Hollywood head turner. He has got the square jaw, he's got the wavy hair, he's got the bulging biceps, he's got the winning smile. And she has set her adulterous, lust-filled heart on him. So that we don't think that this is some nice, pleasant romance story that somehow went wrong. let me point out to you that in verse 7, she comes to Joseph and she's not into romance. She's less than subtle in her demands because she comes and she commands him. She's come to bed with me. In actual fact, it's stronger than that. What she's saying to him is sex now. And she's not going to take no for an answer, because she's going to pursue him day after day. She's going to try and lure him into this affair. She's not going to give up easily because she has got her focus on him. And because of the position that's in, she's not used to not having her own way. So Joseph finds himself in a really delicate situation. He could have thought through the process and said, well, I'm here to serve my master. This is my master's wife. If I have to obey my master, maybe I should obey his wife as well. And he could go and he could sleep with her. He could turn around and say, well, you know, life has been pretty hard for me. You know, my family have turned their back on me. I'm in a country, a nation I don't know. I'm in a language I've had to learn. Okay, I've prospered, but life's been hard. Maybe I deserve a little bit of relief. And, you know, well, if this is, you know, how many people today view sex, if this is just simply a physical act, no strings attached, if it doesn't mean anything other than that, then where's the harm? The thing is, Joseph doesn't see it that way, because Joseph recognizes it for what it is. It is a temptation. He sees through this temptation. And he makes sure that verse 10, he refused to go to bed with her. He refused to be even with her. The implication is, if she is in a room, he makes sure he doesn't go into that room. He's going to ensure that if people have to look after her, he's going to order some of the other servants to do that. It's not going to be him. He's putting wise boundaries in place between himself and this temptation. Let's fast forward it. Put this into our own era, and what would he be doing? Well, he'd be making sure he's never in the same place that she is. When she's phoning him, he's not going to be answering these incoming calls. When he sees a notification on his mobile phone that there's a Snapchat message or a TikTok video or whatever else, he's not going to be opening it. He's not going to be giving her any indication that he has seen these notifications, that he's opened these notifications, that there is any softening whatsoever of his position towards her. He's not going to give her any incentive whatsoever. He sees the temptation and he sees through it, and he's just not going to go there. And yet one day, he finds himself in difficulty. One wonders, the Bible is silent on this, but given her character, one wonders, did she send the other servants out of the house? One wonders, did she somehow make it in such a way that she knew she could be alone with Joseph? And she's going to make the most of that opportunity, and she almost throws herself at him. And he's having none of it, and so he runs. He literally runs away from temptation. She grabs his coat. And that coat is going to be that bit of evidence, isn't it? It's going to be a second time a garment is going to be used as evidence by his adversaries. It's going to result in him being imprisoned. And now we see something of the venom of this woman. We see how quickly she turns from lusting to loathing. What's that old saying about a woman scorned? Well, she is not going to settle until Joseph is dealt with. She has this vindictive streak that just comes up to the fore, and she enlists the household servants, somehow playing off the fact that he's not one of them. He's a foreigner, yet he's promoted above them. She enlists their support. She comes to Potiphar and says, the guy that you've brought in here, he's done this to me. So she's putting the blame on him. And before we know it, here's Joseph. Potiphar's anger is evident. Although, interestingly, Potiphar doesn't kill him. He could easily have ordered him to be killed. But does he suspect his wife is less than pure? We don't quite know. But he's thrown into prison. And so he's languishing here in a prison for an injustice. The second time an injustice comes into this guy's life. And this time it's even worse. And so we're left asking the question, what do you and I learn from an episode like this in the Bible, I want to suggest to you that there's two things that we learn from a passage like this. And the first is this: God sees everything. God sees everything. If you've encountered this story for the first time in the record that the Bible gives to us, you were probably quite surprised at the way verse 9 unfolds. Because when he's given this command to sleep with her, Joseph lists the reasons why that's not going to take place. He lists his privileged position. He lists her privilege, her position her unique position in the household. And then thirdly, he lists the position of knowledge that God has. And you're going, well, that's just come out of nowhere, hasn't it? He says, I can't do this because I can't do such a wicked thing and sin against, we expect the word Potiphar to be there. He's my master. He trusts me. He's given me everything but you. You are his treasured possession in that sense. And you're off limits. How can I possibly do such a thing against Potiphar? No, against God is what the passage says here. And so you may ask the question, does that mean that God actually cares what consenting adults get up to? And the answer to that question is, yes, he does. That's exactly the point. Joseph knew that was the point, even if she didn't. The point is, God does care what consenting adults get up to. Interestingly, before COVID-19 came into our lives and threw everything into an upheaval, the issue that was becoming the most offensive about the teaching of the Christian faith was that of the sexual ethic that the Christian faith speaks of. Used to be the case that it was the exclusive claim of Jesus to be the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through him. But in recent years, it's been this area of sexual ethics that have brought the message of Christianity against the full force of modern society. And so modern society says, listen, consenting adults can do what they like, with whom they like, when they like. Our society says, listen, we have fought hard for the sexual freedoms that we now enjoy. And so how dare how dare the Christian message somehow suggest that this hard-fought freedoms that we have should be curtailed? And yet, that's exactly what the message of the Bible says. Interestingly, before COVID came on the go, there was a book that was published from a Christian perspective to try and help people navigate this whole issue, because for many folks in society today, it's alien. You mean God actually cares about these things? And so there's a book here, Why Does God Care Who I Sleep With? By Sam Albury. Sam spoke here a number of years ago. It's a really helpful book. Check out our social media platforms after the service for a link as to where you can get that book. Anyway, let me go back to where we were. Does God care what goes on between consenting adults? Yes, God does. And not in the way that society tells us that God does. Society says that God is against sex, and that God wants to somehow stamp it out if possible, which is ludicrous, because the Bible tells us that God has made us, and that when God made us, there was this oneness, physically, emotionally, sexually. God made us with this mandate to procreate, to go out and fill this world with people. God is not against sex. Rather, sex is one of the gifts that God has given to us. The gift of sexual intimacy is a gift that God has given, a gift that needs to be used in its right environment and recognized for the costliness of the gift that it actually is. It has to be used in the right environment. And the Bible tells us that the right environment for sexual intimacy is between one man and one woman for life, having come together before God, committing themselves to God in what we call marriage. And anything out of that, whether it is from a heterosexual point of view or from a homosexual point of view, anything out of that strays out of the boundaries that God permits. and strays in, as far as Joseph is concerned, strays into a wicked thing and a sin against God. In its right environment, sex is a gift that God has given to us. And we realize that there are things in this life that can only be used in the right environment. A couple of days back, the weather changed so much that I put the fire on in our lounge. The day before, we'd sat out for lunch. The sun was beating down on us. It was almost too warm for a Piliwali Highlander skin. It was almost too warm. But the next day, it's cold, so the fire goes on. And you put the fire on in the right environment, and you can lit the logs, you can see the flames, you can experience the pleasure of the warmth. What if I decided that that was just way too restrictive? What if I decided that that just somehow was an affront to my freedom? Why should I be constrained to have the gift of fire with all of the warmth and the light and the good things that come from it? Why should I be constrained to have that in one place? Why not go upstairs to one of the bedrooms upstairs and light a fire up there? Well, what happens if you light a fire in an upstairs bedroom? Well, the place burns down, doesn't it? What happens when you light the fire of the gift of sex in a bedroom that it ought not to be lit? Well, it's not flames of passion that are seen coming from that bedroom. It is destruction that flows from that bedroom. And the impact doesn't simply have an impact horizontally on the people involved. It has an impact vertically too. Because sex is not simply this act, this physical urge that we meet every now and then we move on from it. The Bible tells us it's more than that. Because the Bible tells us it is a sign of how we are handing ourselves over to somebody, physically, emotionally, intellectually, that we are open with somebody, that we're connecting with our deepest, innermost beings with somebody. Sex for the sex of it, or for the sake of it, is just saying, I want you, but I don't trust you. And I don't want to share my life with you. And I don't want you to share your life with me. It's just a physical act. That is not the environment that God has given. And Joseph recognized that. Because the problem is not simply that she was Potiphar's wife, it's that she wasn't his wife. He hadn't committed to her emotionally, intellectually, physically. She wasn't everything to him. Because when she is everything to him and connected to him in a lifelong bond, that's the arena for Joseph. And it would be in the future for him. So in its right context, sexual intimacy is a gift from God, the God who sees everything. And it's a gift that's costly. And when we devalue that gift, we lose something so significant for it. Just a year or two back, we learned of a man who in 1964 bought this little chess piece. And he had it in the family for 55 years. It went down a couple of generations before the family recognized that this was one of the missing Lewis chessmen pieces that had been missing for some 200 years. When the family realized this and they went up for sale, it was sold for £735,000. The guy bought it in 65 for a fiver. He didn't realize that this actually was worth so much more than he realized. He didn't realize that the costliness of this gift far exceeded what he understood. Our generation, sexual freedoms. Yet this is a generation of the Me Too movement. This is a generation of the exploitation, human slavery for the sex trade. This is a generation that on our news we're seeing that we have a once in a lifetime, once in a generation opportunity to deal with the high rates of sexually transmitted infections. We're not realizing that the gift that God has given is a costly gift. It's a precious gift to be used in the right environment. And out with of that environment, God sees. God sees everything. And Joseph knew that. And so Joseph was not willing to cross that line to argue away the whole notion of what he was about to do, because he knew that God sees. And it's not simply that God sees on a sexual basis. God sees everything. Every movement of every muscle of our bodies, every motive behind the words that leave our mouths or behind the actions that we do. God sees everything. And the knowledge that God sees is a very powerful guard against falling into temptation. The knowledge that God is there and God knows, because he sees everything. So the first thing that we learn from a passage like this is we admire in many ways how Joseph was able to withstand this temptation, because he's a red-blooded male. The chances are that Potiphar would have had his pick of wives, so she would have no doubt been a beautiful individual on the outside. She wasn't on the inside. Joseph saw through it because he knew that God sees. Second thing we learn from this is that God sees because God is everywhere. And you think, well, that's obvious. But let me explain why I'm saying that. God sees because God is everywhere. That's the second thing that we learn here. Well, you may respond to me and say, well, listen, Alistair, this whole episode's a bit strange, because this is hardly an incentive to do the right thing in life, is it? This guy did the right thing, and look at the consequences that came his way for it. This is a guy who now finds himself in prison, chained, with next to no sense that parole might be an option for him in the future. And so what benefit is there in actually doing the right thing? We're reminded that in this world, doing the right thing doesn't always turn out the right way for us immediately. The Bible tells us that in this world we'll know troubles, but we're to be of good cheer, because Jesus has overcome this world. The Bible gives us a list of people of faith who did the right thing and it cost them. We could think of Moses. In Hebrews chapter 11, which we'll be studying this evening, Hebrews chapter 11, we're not at this stage yet, but later on in that chapter, it talks about Moses. He's the guy who, rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, chose to be mistreated with the people of God. We can read of people in the Bible like Paul, who were sent to prison, or John, who was exiled to an island like Patmos, or Lazarus, who succumbed to disease, or Daniel, who's thrown into a den of lions. And they were doing the right things, these guys. And yet ultimately, even although they had trouble in the light of doing the right thing, we see that God reversed that trouble. Whether it was Paul in prison, he's writing letters that become the New Testament. Whether it's Daniel thrown to the lion's den and saved from the lion's den, he reveals the care of God. Whether it's John exiled to Patmos, he sees heaven. Where Lazarus, having succumbed to disease, is raised to life, and many people come to trust in Jesus because of him. Because even when bad things happen to us for doing the right thing, God so orders it that it will work out. And so how does it work out for Joseph? Well, who knows what's going through Joseph's head, but let's run with it for a minute. You can almost imagine Joseph there, hour after hour, day after day, thinking about this latest unjust action that he's been subject to. And it might be the case that Joseph is quite like us when we face injustice and we're slandered. Because for us, it's not necessarily the person who's spreading the lies that we get frustrated with. We get frustrated that the people who should know better, who know us better, and who shouldn't believe the lies. And so you think of Joseph, and well, Potiphar's wife is one thing, but Potiphar, 11 years I've worked for him. He's entrusted me with everything. When have I ever acted in such a way that would give him thought that I would do this to him or to his wife? And so he's in this situation with all that's going through his mind, facing this injustice, and yet, in that situation, he's in the very place where God is going to enable him to meet the man who's going to bring him to Pharaoh and to be in the position of prime minister in this country. God sees everything because he is everywhere. He is the one who recognizes all that is done. He is the one who isn't just sometimes sovereign. He's not the one who is occasionally victorious. He is the one who is working out all of his plans and purposes, even through the evils that may be done to us or done to our family or done to others. And so your life today might leave you completely confused. You've no idea why certain things are unfolding in your life, and that may be true. But there's no confusion with God. There's no bewilderment with God. God sees, God is there, God understands. He knows exactly what is going on with you. And so, with Joseph here, he is somebody who is in exactly the place where God is wanting him to be, because God is going to enable him to meet the guy who's going to put him in the position where he's going to be the blessing to all, not simply that nation, but to all the nations. He's going to be the guy that is going to see the people of God turn into a nation under his influence over successive generations. He's going to be in the place where God wants him to be. Because I don't know, did you notice in verse 2 at the start of this chapter, and then in verse 21 at the end of this chapter, you've got the same thing. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered. While Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. Because God sees everything. He sees every injustice. He sees every right decision that's made. And he overrules everything. And so, as we come to close today, you may be thinking, well, this message isn't necessarily the most appealing, attractive message for Christianity, because this is telling us that the message of Christianity can impact my freedom. This is telling me that the message of Christianity is going to impact my sexual freedom, or the message of Christianity is going to impact perhaps my life and my comforts. Well, why would I be willing to go through something like that? Why would anybody possibly want to go through a message that would somehow lead to restriction in our lives? It must mean that the core message of Christianity, which is about a person and about Jesus Christ, it must mean that the message of who Jesus is must be so appealing and attractive that it makes these other things somehow lose their significance. And that's exactly the key. Because in Joseph's life, we get a glimpse of what we see in a full panoramic view in the life of Jesus. Because the story of Joseph, it intersects our lives as we think of Jesus Christ in the following ways. Number one, we think of Jesus Christ, the full panorama of God's dealings with us, in the way in which he is named. Think back to Christmas and all these cards that you get. He will be called Emmanuel, which means what? God with us. What have we just said at the beginning of this chapter, verse 2? On the way up, God is with Joseph. Verse 21, on the way down, God is with Joseph. What does the New Testament tell us? God is with his people now in Jesus Christ in a far greater way. Jesus came into this world, knew the restrictions, the confinement, remained uncontaminated by the pollution of this world. He lived in this world with us. He died in this world for us. He rose from the dead so that we might be secure and free. And he has promised to be with us always. That's one way in which the message of Joseph intersects our lives through the fuller understanding that we have through Jesus Christ. Like Joseph, we think of Jesus, one who had such a descent. We would think of Joseph's position and Joseph going from a situation where he was in this penthouse and he goes down to a prison. And of all the different things that he had to give up to get to that position, well, what more about Jesus? Going from that palace and glory in heaven above to come into this world of brokenness, to be rejected and to be despised, and ultimately to die, but not simply to die a normal death surrounded by our family breathing our last, but to die that cursed death on the cross. How low did Jesus have to go? How Joseph had to go from that position of influence and authority to mingling with the guilty criminals. And how Jesus went from that position of glory with his Father in that spotless purity. And there on the cross of Calvary, he is identified with the transgressors, with sinners, because my sin and your sin is concentrated on him. That's what Jesus has done. So the message of Joseph intersects our lives because of the greater unfolding message of Jesus, because of his name, and because of the journey that Jesus had to go through, because of the temptation that Jesus had to face. Joseph was tempted here. My, he was tempted. There's probably few of us who could withstand this constant temptation that he went through. And yet Joseph was not perfect. We know that from chapter 37. The temptation gets stronger the more we try and fight it. So who fought temptation the most? Well, that was Jesus Christ. Temptation on every level. The Bible tells us he was tempted in every way like we are. Every single way that you can think of being tempted, so was Jesus. And yet he was tempted in additional ways as well. Not simply tempted in the way that we are tempted, but tempted with all these assaults from the enemy. As Jesus is tempted by Satan. You know, you don't have to go over the way of the cross. Are these people that you're going to save really worth it? Really, you're going to die there in agony? You're going to be abandoned? Does the Father really love you? Have you made a mistake? Oh, what a mistake you've made, for these people are going to let you down. He was tempted. And he withstood. He withstood because of the love that he had for his Father and the love that he had for his people. That's me and you. And you see, when you begin to appreciate the love that Jesus has for us, then he begins to become our passion. And when he becomes our passion, then things that were our passions beforehand that we knew could never satisfy, they take their right position before the passion that can satisfy. And I'm conscious that we could go on, but our time is almost over. How do we respond to Jesus then today? Well, some of us might be responding and saying, well, listen, this whole sexual temptation thing, this whole God-seeing thing, not simply maybe sexually, but things I've said, things I've heard, I mean, the evidence against me before God is just enormous. How can I possibly hope to stand before this God at the end of time? I don't know how it's going to be done. I want you to bear in mind as we finish, just with this little reminder of what took place with Jesus in John chapter 8. Read it for yourself later. This woman was being dragged before Jesus because she was caught in the act of adultery. The group who gathered her there wanted her to be stoned and said, listen, the law says she should be stoned to death. And Jesus is ignoring them. They keep on going on. She should be stoned to death. Eventually, Jesus stands up and he says, he who is without sin, let him cast the first stone. And convicted, they all left, because every one of us is convicted before God. What did Jesus say to the woman? He said, go and sin no more. We may have joined this service today with a whole host of different things, lots of different baggage. The message of the Bible is come to Jesus, meet Jesus, and it's turned from our sin. And doing the right thing may cost, but remember, God has a plan. Story is told, and this one I definitely will finish. Story is told of a guy who lived in the Great Depression in the 1930s. He lost his job, he lost his home, he actually lost his wife and family as well. And he was depressed because of it. Who could blame him? He was walking along and he was seeing one of the few building sites that were still operating. They were actually building a church building. and he saw this stonemason who was angling this stone, making it into a tiny, small, very triangular piece. And he said, "What are you doing?" And the guy said, "Well, can you look up at the building there? Can you see that spire? Can you see there's a little opening up near the top of where that spire begins? Can you see it?" And he went, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I'm chiseling this down here so that it fits up there." The guy who was a believer knew instantly it was a message ultimately from God. That he has been chiseled just now down here so he can fit up there. You may be living with injustice today. You may be living with slander. You may be on the end of vindictive behavior. You may be on the end of a whole host of things that you would never choose. If you're one of the people of God, let's hang on to this. Let's remember, God is chiseling us down here so that we fit up there in heaven, being the people he wants us to be. God sees. And because God sees, God's everywhere. He knows. And he's with us, and he's with you, and he invites you today to come to him.